I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Adam Getachew, Neubauer Family Assistant Professor of Political Science and College at the University of Chicago. We're discussing her 2019 book, World Making After Empire, The Rise and Fall of Self-Determination, from Princeton University Press. Getachew works on the history of political thought, theories of race and empire, and post-colonial political theory. Her work focuses on the intellectual and political histories of Africa and the Caribbean, and has published widely on these topics. First of all, Adam Getachew, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thanks for having me.
Adam, I love this book. It's a really illuminating and comprehensive study of Black Anglophone anti-colonial critics in the 20th century, and the focus on world making as a strategy that brought them together, I thought was really, really compelling. So, you know, nice work here. Thanks for the work. Now, let me ask you first, just to get us started, what was the motivation for writing the book?
Sure. I mean, there was a bunch of different motivations, I think. This was my dissertation that I did in a joint PhD program at Yale in political science and African American studies. And I think there were both kind of intellectual questions and problems in those two fields that I was interested in being in conversation with, and also just a sense of the world, our contemporary world. So let me start with the kind of political context in which I was thinking about the project, and then move into the kind of intellectual debates I was interested in. So when I submitted my prospectus for the dissertation, actually the framing kind of preamble to the set of questions I was asking was really around the Libya intervention had just happened. It had happened under the guise of a norm of responsibility to protect. So it came from a sense that, an older set of ways of thinking about international order organized around sovereign equality, non-intervention, had really come to maybe an end in some way, or were being really radically transformed in the practices of international politics. And of course, that didn't start with Libya, but that was the specific context in which I was writing. And in some ways, there's been, a corner of political theory that's been taken up as a real transformation of a world of nation states to a cosmopolitan world order, right? So there was some uneasiness for me about that transformation, especially as seen through the light of the various ways in which hierarchy and power continue to persist and maybe were obscured by these new languages of cosmopolitan norms. So one set of one kind of thing I wanted to do in the project was recover and reconstruct different ways of thinking about internationalisms that grew out of a deep critique of empire, to suggest that that period we associate with the world of nation states was actually also a moment in which there was a critique of the nation state, a different one perhaps than cosmopolitan critics or theorists have today, but one that similarly generated different ways about thinking about how to organize the world order and whether that kind of vision might have lessons for our contemporary moment. So that's one kind of debate I wanted to intervene in. The second is that, again, I was in grad school after about 20 years of work in political theory on empire, right, that has really helped us rethink the canon of political thought, recovering for us the ways in which reflections about the extra-European world, about empire, had been central to canonical figures throughout the modern era. And so with that kind of backdrop in mind, I really wanted to recover and reconstruct those thinkers who were responding to the predicaments outlined by those canonical thinkers on empire, and to think about a sort of at least one tradition of anti-imperial thought in the 20th century. I'm sure we'll get into this, but I think my figures, most of them are politicians, right? But I think one of the reasons I was drawn to them were they were also in various ways intellectuals, people who thought very seriously about politics and and wrote quite a lot about what they thought they were doing. And so I was thinking about a set of people who are engaged in practice and practical transformation, as well as in the world of ideas. Then the third thing, I guess, came more from my location in African American studies. And they're beginning with Paul Gilroy's Black Atlantic, a term I also borrow from the 90s. There's been a ton of work on recovering what we might call Black internationalism, thinking about the ways in which African, Caribbean, African American writers, cultural producers developed shared frameworks, fora, et cetera, for discussing and thinking through the problem of race in the 20th century. A lot of that work focuses really on the interwar period, and there's a sense in that literature that that rich kind of internationalism really comes to an end with the period of decolonization I'm interested in. And so I wanted to recover and think about what forms of internationalism persist after World War II.
Maybe the place to start, I was going to ask you about this in a minute, but you raised the point about the various thinkers and politicians that you discuss in the book. I thought maybe it's a good, maybe if you could say a little bit about the sort of cast of characters as were here in your book, just to kind of orient us. You know, some of our familiar figures probably for many of us, like W.E.B. Du Bois. But then there are other sort of less familiar figures. And indeed, you did a lot of archival research for this book, which is quite interesting, and I'd love to hear about that. But if you know, just want to sort of start by, you know, kind of taking us through who the overall figures are here that you're discussing, and you know, why you picked them in particular.
Yes, sure. You know, I think the figure probably most familiar to political theorists will be W.E.B. Du Bois. For me, he's not a very present figure, but I think he informs the kind of arc of the book. I mean, he's, of course, as early as 1900, describes the world as divided by a global color line. Contributes to the creation of some of the forum that would be really important for a set of anti-colonial nationalists, especially the Pan-Africanist circles that he helps congresses that he helps to found beginning in 1919. So he's, and I have this, I can maybe talk about it later, but with Jennifer Pitts, I've also edited a collection of his international writing spanning 1900 to 1956. And I think, you know, we often teach him and think about him in an American context, but he's a figure who really thought the question of race in America in a global context and an imperial context, and had much to say about the forms of hierarchy that structured the world order. So he's sort of an early figure, of course, also much older than the rest of the characters in the book. Then I was interested in pairing as African and Caribbean thinkers. I mean, this comes from that commitment of trying to think about the space of the Black Atlantic and as a space of exchange, as a set of networks. Many of the figures knew each other or overlapped in certain kinds of ways. So I'll just introduce two other sets of characters. One set is Kwame Nkrumah and Eric Williams. Kwame Nkrumah is the first prime minister of Ghana. He studies in the United States at Historically Black College. And Eric Williams is Trinidadian. He's a Rhodes Scholar, a professor at Howard for 10 years. And so those two figures are both, born around 1909, 1910. They come to age, the 30s is really a profound moment for both of them. And that's, of course, also the moment of the Italian invasion of Ethiopia. So these thinkers, as we'll talk about later, are important because they're the kind of figures through which I examine the question of regional federation. And I think one other thing to mention about Williams in particular, of course, is he wrote a very important book called Capitalism and Slavery that tried to think about slavery in the Americas as the kind of foundational moment or origin story of kind of the Industrial Revolution. A very controversial thesis, but one that really helps to inform his political project, as I'll talk about later. And then maybe another set of characters is Julius Nyerere of Tanzania, Michael Manley of Jamaica. Now, these figures are about a decade younger than Nkrumah and Williams. They come to age in the 40s and come to power, political power later also. So in part, what's interesting about these figures is they're responding to the contradictions and limits of the earlier moment. Both have to, you know, think about their political projects in the context where the regional federations that Nkrumah and Williams inaugurated have failed. They're also, you know, want to rethink what development looks like. And those two figures for me are associated with the new international economic order of the 1970s. So there's a few other characters that float in and out, but I think that gives you the kind of arc of the book.
Yeah, that's good. So we get to move into your thesis of the book, where just to sort of lay out the overall claim. I mean, as far as I understand, you know, what you're up to is, you know, you're tracing a series of thinkers' reflections on self-determination, right, in a post-colonial context. And the question I think that arises for these thinkers is, what are the conditions for self-determination? And, you know, there's a sort of traditional Westphalian view, of course, of state sovereignty that just assumes, yeah, if you get the right to say self-determination, you can be left alone to sort of determine your fate, as it were. But thinkers that you're analyzing here argue that it's not so simple, that post-colonial states exist in a conditions of dependence on economic dependence and other forms of dependence that makes it very difficult to exercise a form of self-determination. It requires more, you know, an international or federal, in the case of say Williams, efforts to sort of enjoy that right to self-determination. Is that, maybe we want to add or amend that sort of summary?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think maybe one just way to accentuate the point is that, you know, dependence is one feature of this broader claim that this set of figures is making, which is that empire as a process of both integrating the world, making the world one world, produced a set of deep forms of hierarchy. These could be legal, we can talk about political, economic. And I think the profound point, especially for the Caribbean thinkers, is that these very societies, right, the processes of settler colonialism, African enslavement, these societies were produced out of that process, right? So there's no, that division that I think the Westphalian conception or a standard conception of self-determination implies a kind of that the domestic and international are disaggregable from each other, right? That one could organize one's polity internally first, perhaps, and then engage in a set of international relations. In some deep way, the point here is that it's actually the historical process through which these societies came into being, we might say, has been completely reversed, right? And so that means for them that there is no way to think the domestic outside of the international.
Right. Is it fair to say, I was curious, for these thinkers, is sovereignty, it's not the starting point of, you know, self-determination, but is it the end point? I mean, is it the ultimate goal for these thinkers to achieve a condition in which, you know, the variety of countries on Earth, as a result of the sort of international systems that they want to set up, that sovereignty is the ultimate goal, but not, they reject the idea that it's a beginning point?
Yes, I think there's a little bit of, ambivalence around this point, and maybe also ambivalence on my part, which we can talk about. I mean, I think on the one hand, part of the point is that simply formal sovereignty is not going to be, or legal sovereignty, right, is not going to be sufficient, right, because there are these deeper set of hierarchies, there are various forms of dependence, especially economic dependence, that mean that any that the independence of these new societies and newly independent societies is always potentially going to be undermined, you know, in some cases by more powerful actors on the international stage, and in some times not just by the mere structure of the economic relations that connect these societies to the wider world. So I think on the one hand, there's a critique of the limits of sovereignty, but I think this is one difference with the kind of contemporary cosmopolitan project. The kinds of international projects that they're imagining are often attempts to make sovereignty realize its promise of independence, if that makes sense. So let's take the example of federation. So one of the things that's really striking in the Federation's example is that Ghana, but also Guinea, their first their early constitutions all suggest that they will hand over or delegate the national sovereignty to a regional power or a union of African states. I mean, this is a very striking thing in a constitution, right? To say that one would forego sovereignty, but at what at least from the Nkrumah's perspective, what that structure, Union of African States, would do is aggregate sovereignty at a regional level, right? It's a form of federation that aims by enlarging the territorial unit of realizing what sovereignty would enable, i.e. Independence and equality on the international stage. I think there are other moments where it seems like the internationalism imagined, you know, really points to the possibility of pointing beyond realizing sovereignty. And in some ways, I think the attempts to internationally regulate the economy in ways such that domestic economies would have to be restructured on the terms of a global redistributionist vision suggest a more fundamental, I think, reworking of sovereignty. But I think there's also kind of a historical arc in the book where over the course of the narrative I tell, the kind of attachment to a more standard conception of sovereignty gets gradually strengthened. We can see this in the kind of ways in which arguments for non-intervention become really important in the UN. We can see it also in the ways that regional organizations, especially the Union of the Organization of African States, doubles down on this conception of non-intervention.
This is good. I mean, you can tell kind of sort of where I'm headed in a certain way, because I do find this, you know, the debate that you mentioned at the very beginning between sort of nationalists and cosmopolitans and contemporary political philosophy to be quite interesting. Because in some ways, you know, I'm still trying to think through how these thinkers can help with that debate, in the sense that it strikes me that this is a difficult tension to navigate. If you're a cosmopolitan and you want to, you know, sort of hand over sovereignty to higher levels, to federation, and ultimately to a world state, in the case of some cosmopolitans, you know, that comes at the expense, or at least that seems to come in tension with national self-determination. But if you're going to, you know, sort of reserve rights, national self-determination, that's going to be difficult then to, you know, that's going to come at the expense of some of the aims of the cosmopolitan order. So I'm jumping right to the political theory points as opposed to sort of taking us through the historical. So I apologize, but, you know, feel free to just say, hey, look, let's take this up after we get through the history. But I don't know if you have any reactions to that.
I mean, I think one kind of thing I'm trying to suggest about the contemporary cosmopolitan debate is, can we kind of expand what we take to be the problem with the nation state, I think. So So this, you know, one way to tell the kind of story about cosmopolitanism in its Habermasian, post-Habermasian perspective is one that takes the experience of the European nation state as the starting point of critique. That is to say, the exemplary problem of the nation state is the Holocaust, right? And then of course we can imagine other iterations of that, you know, that have also occurred in the post-colonial world, including, you know, Rwanda, most importantly, right? But the question that cosmopolitan or the cosmopolitan critique of the nation state is one that's primarily focused on the ways in which international protection of sovereignty undermines individual rights, right? And that's the thing that the cosmopolitan is seeking to overcome through whether it's regionalism, whether it's the world state, right? That disaggregating sovereignty and transforming the relationship between the domestic and the international might enable better protections of individual rights. One thing I'm trying to suggest is that was that the only problem with the nation state? So it's like, let's look at the same 20th century history from the perspective of the colonized world, right? And there, I mean, of course, one part of the problem is that most people in the world didn't have sovereignty, right? But more importantly, I think there's a different critique of the nation state, which I think equally holds now, which is the nation state the best institutional form for the realization of our collective aspirations for self-rule, for equality, for independence? And here, I think that seems to be a more just as profound a problem for us today as it was for these figures, right? Whether it's the forms of economic interrelationships that we have on the global stage, whether it's the question of climate crisis, right? It seems like it's not just that the nation state is a site of perpetuating unchecked violence, right? But it's also an institutional form that remains unable to resolve some of these fundamental dilemmas and crises of our time. And the point is, then the question is, I think, for cosmopolitans, are the kinds of institutional forms designed to do the first thing, protect the rights of individuals, also able to fulfill these more collective aspirations for self-rule, for equality? And whether, you know, by attending to different ways in which the nation state was problematized by different kinds of thinkers and actors and historical moments, could we think about these two as kind of potentially disaggregable, right? So I'm not sure I fully resolved your question, but I think that's kind of the intervention I'm trying to make vis-a-vis the literature.
Yeah, that is really helpful. I mean, it especially is, you know, there's this point at the end of your fifth chapter that you mention Rawls and Charles Bates, and you could add a number of other liberal cosmopolitan figures who sort of conceive of justice, you know, very much in individual, like atomistic terms. And you can see how what you just sketched is background for that kind of approach to global justice, right? Because the concern is, how do individuals fare, right? What is the just organization for individuals? You know, there's sort of sufficient primary goods for them to enjoy their lives. But what you're pointing to is really helpful, which is like a completely alternative, different way of looking at normative problems in the global arena, which is problems not having to do with individuals, but having problems having to do with collective self-determination. And that raises a whole different set of normative questions. So in other words, yes, that's very helpful.
Yeah. I mean, another way to put it, I think another piece of this is, you know, I think the preoccupation, we can get to what the difference is between like Bites and others who do argue for more distributive claims, you know, whose cosmopolitanism is a distributive one. The way the difference I was sketching, the preoccupation with the state as the kind of violator of individual rights, I think always imagines the international as a kind of defensive posture, right? We turn to international institutions or regional institutions as a way of creating a set of restraints on state action, right? What I think is really powerful about this set of thinkers is that they don't imagine international institutions only as a site of negative restraint, right? But a site of actually, realizing a set of positive aspirations, right? That actually our collective, our aspiration for collective self-government can only be realized if we design our collective institutions in a certain kind of way, not only to prevent one state from encroaching on another state, right? But to create the conditions in which one state, within one state, citizens might realize their collective aspiration for self-government. So I think there's also a way, I hope, that the book opens up a kind of imaginative space to think about what the international could be beyond a set of restraints on state power.
Yeah, great. So let's sort of walk through, you know, the chapters of your book and the parts of the story that you tell in the, you know, the 20th century. You begin in chapter two with the League of Nations and the putative origin, anyway, the principle of self-determination with Woodrow Wilson. You challenge the idea that this principle really started with him or was defended by him, but that he was actually a counter-revolutionary force. Maybe you could discuss that argument here.
Sure. I think this. I'm trying to challenge this argument that self-determination begins with Wilson and begins with a Wilsonian moment. And it's funny to try and do that, but then start with him anyway. So here it goes. But I think the point here is to say two things. I mean, the counter-revolutionary part of Wilson, I want to locate in two ways. One is to suggest that it's in response to the Russian Revolution and to the Russian Revolution's articulation of a principle of self-determination, its vision of a worldwide revolution, that's one kind of framing and central framing of self-determination to which Wilson is responding. The second way he's a counter-revolutionary or a skeptic of revolution is his, as I try to suggest, he has a deeply Burkean critique of universal principles. And this is drawn in part from, a profound and critique of emancipation and reconstruction in the United States. So it's partly that experience or his kind of account of what the problem with Reconstruction was as a political project that informs his kind of international vision.
You know, I was curious in terms of the Burkean counter-revolutionary heritage here. I mean, you know, in some ways, I mean, when I think of counter-revolutionary, you know, orientation or disposition, I think of something like, you know, reactionary, like Joseph de Maistre or something. Whereas when I think of Burke, I think of critic of revolution, but, you know, a gradualist in orientation. Was Wilson sort of, I mean, I don't know much about Wilson, but he doesn't seem to be sort of a reactionary figure like that. It seems like, you know, kind of when I think of John Stuart Mill, right, and the way John Stuart Mill sort of would conceive of, well, there are just some peoples on earth that require tutelary government, that are not prepared for self-government or whatever. That seems to be like Wilson's view. Is that right?
Yeah. So I want to say I agree with you. I don't think of Burke himself as counter-revolutionary. So I think that what Wilson and the other figure in this chapter is Jan Smuts, the South African thinker. What both of them draw from Burke is an anxiety about abstract universals. And when faced with the fact that one particular universal, i.e. the idea of self-determination, is circulating, both of them seek to particularize it, right? Fill it out, delimit its extension. And what my argument about Wilson is that, yes, there is some part of him that is an extension of kind of the liberal imperialism argument that, you know, a set of people just have not reached the stage at which they can exercise self-determination. But at the same time, I think with him, there is a deep skepticism about whether they will ever actually reach that stage. One could say that that skepticism is already built into that earlier liberal imperialist moment. Like the when of when tutelage will end was always kind of a question, right? But I think so for instance, to just give a concrete example about what when he writes about the Philippines, you know, what he says there about why they're not ready for independence it's not just they haven't, you know, cultivated the appropriate political habits, they haven't gone a process of modernization, but the very character of the people as a kind of mixed race society, as a society where there was no kind of unified people, made them unable to, you know, to realize self-determination. And I think in that suggestion, and in some of the other pieces on the formation of the League too, there's this real questioning of whether in fact this form of tutelary power is just a temporary thing. And I think in Wilson, it's ambivalent, right? Both of those features are there. I introduced Smuts into the chapter because he's someone who basically offers a solution, right, in some way by suggesting that it doesn't matter really whether or not this is a temporary or permanent solution, because he wants to argue that even in this differentiated and hierarchical formation, self-determination has already been realized. And this is a kind of proto argument for the apartheid state in South Africa, but that something like the native authority, the Bantustan, realizes self-determination in an appropriate form for the people in that context, right? So in that sense, it's not that self-determination is something that has to be realized in the future. It's already been realized, but just realized in this differentiated way.
To turn from the League of Nations to the UN, so sort of the positive figures of the start to the positive figures of the book. So this is skipping ahead, obviously, in history to after World War II. But this is where you get into the story of the role of anti-colonial nationalists in reinventing the principle of self-determination, taking it away from, say, this Jan Smuts approach to it. I thought maybe you could first sort of give the historical account of how that came about, you know, sort of from the UN, you know, original proposal and how it was revised by the group of thinkers you discuss. And then we can talk about the theoretical significance after that.
Okay, great. Yeah. So the, you know, part of the intervention here is to say that it wasn't the right to self-determination was not written into the founding documents of the UN, whether that's the UN Charter or the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And in fact, it was a topic of constant conversation and critique during between 1940 and 48 that it had been excluded. So the historical process is one in which, one, outside of the framework of the UN, this is like the Bandung Conference of 1955, a meeting of Afro-Asian states, in other kinds of networks. This argument for the right to self-determination is being articulated, is being made. One version that appears in the 1955 Bandung Conference in particular is this idea that the right to self-determination is a prerequisite for other human rights. And we can talk about what that meant. So it would be partly this form of this argument would be the one that entered into the space of the UN. And it's a long and complicated process, you know, back and forth between 45 and 1960 about when a right to self-determination does appear. It appears in two ways. One, through this Resolution 1514, the Declaration on the Granting of Independence to Colonial Countries and Peoples, and then in the kind of the covenants of, on human rights, one on civil and political rights, one on economic, social, and cultural rights. That's ratified in 1966, and in that context, it appears as Article 1. It's listed as the first right in both of those documents, and with the same language. So the process, in part, is to I recount this historical process to illuminate just how much of a fight it was to get the right to self-determination introduced, and to suggest then, to make the argument that it was really a kind of anti-colonial project of inserting this right, rather than one that was just simply a realization or expansion of something that a right that had already been articulated in advance.
You know, sort of, I guess the typical way of thinking about this is a, you know, somewhat standard liberal way of thinking about it, that once you have a form of state sovereignty and you enter into the Westphalian system, you're sort of liberated then to exercise that state sovereignty as you see fit. But, you know, there's a different origin of this idea than that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. So part of what I'm interested in doing in this chapter also is trying to say what formulation of the problem of imperial domination was self-determination an answer to. And here I try to reconstruct an argument that of through this Black Atlantic tradition that empire was a form of enslavement. And you know, this took a variety of different forms. It emphasized a certain form of racialized exclusion from civil and political rights. This idea that the colony was this space governed by special laws. Two, there was an emphasis here on arbitrary power, especially the arbitrary power of two figures that kind of epitomize colonial rule, the district officer, who's often the kind of nearest colonial officer that people would interact with, and interestingly, native authorities or chiefs, who were a primary, intermediary power between the colonial state and colonized subjects, especially in rural areas. And then third, an argument of kind of economic extraction and exploitation. And here on this third point, I think there was an argument that of trying to read the colonial expansion into Africa, which happened in the late 19th century, as an extension of the an extension of the forms of enslavement that had occurred in the New World. So, and to make the point that it was the extraction and exploitation of Black labor that held together that earlier moment and this later moment. So this is a quite, I think, so that's one part of the thesis of empire's enslavement. The second piece of it is that this structure, which is largely, as I've described it so far, a domestic structure, right? These are all relations that are happening primarily within the colony itself, except perhaps the exploitation one. But that what enables this structure is a kind of international apparatus through which European states collaborated to enact their kind of supremacy on the world stage. And it's at the same time, I think the argument about its international structure is one that suggests that the institutional form, i.e. whether a place was a colony, a protectorate, a mandate state, or sometimes a peripheral state, as Ethiopia and Liberia were, didn't really matter so much to this basic apparatus, right? So having laid out this thesis of empire as enslavement, I then try to think about how the right to self-determination responds to these different forms of thinking of empire.
That's great. I mean, I was thinking maybe you could elaborate on, you know, that idea you brought up a couple minutes ago that sort of takes off from here, which is that, that, you know, the right to self-determination is this basis of other rights. And maybe as a way to sort of say a little bit more about, you know, the normative groundwork at work here, which is to say, which I'm kind of interested in the sense that, you know, what's the basis for the claim that colonialism amounts to slavery? I mean, in some thinkers, it seems to be a, you know, kind of Marxian inspired approach or understanding in terms of exploitation or economic dependence. At some points, it seems to be a kind of liberal approach or Republican approach, I guess, as we would say now, a kind of approach to thinking about non-domination and arbitrary power. You know, but this is, it's connected to this idea of, you know, that it's the collectivity that's being enslaved in the international order, right? So that's, you know, that gives it a particular cast that's, you know, quite interesting and unique here. So does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I think, one, you're right that the thesis of empire's enslavement, as I reconstruct it from these various thinkers, doesn't have one kind of intellectual pedigree. There is, for some figures, really profound influence of kind of Marxist thought in this period, especially through kind of Lenin in particular. But at the same time, there's also more liberal and Republican dimensions of this. And partly, you know, I think there's a strategic reason. Partly, I think this just reflects their own intellectual and political formations, right? Some figures come out of the Communist International. Others emerged out of much more kind of, had just different kinds of intellectual and political formations. Someone like, say, Eric Williams, for instance, was far from these Marxist circles, actually. And Du Bois himself, you know, this is the period, of course, he's read Marx in the 30s, but it was always a kind of unorthodox approach, let's say, to his Marxism. So I think it's a quite eclectic intellectual tradition that's borrowing from a variety of sources. I think there's also a strategic reason to present oneself as you know, this is, of course, the period of the Cold War. The figures are trying to locate themselves, situate themselves against the two powers. But I think to turn to the more theoretical part of your question, I think there's, so part of it is, it does end up emphasizing the collective, a collective framework, but I think it does so through, let's say, a kind of a critique of the limits of individuated human rights. So in the one way to get at this is kind of in conversation with figures like Hannah Arendt, who are writing in the same period about the limits of human rights, right? And the argument is like, you know, as she would put it, well, what secures the right to have rights? What's the kind of way in which human rights can be institutionalized in a political space, in a political infrastructure? And I think that's what generates a similar move generates the argument for a collective claim of self-determination as the prerequisite for human rights. So the argument is that it may be that individuals have human rights, but those human rights are only realized or can only be realizable as the rights of citizens, right? And in a kind of self-governing political community. So that's the kind of argument for why self-determination is thought of as a prerequisite for human rights. Now, I want to say a couple of things about this. One, I think sometimes the argument takes the form of a one in which there's a kind of like either chronological, you know, say politically strategic prioritization of of self-rule, like Nkrumah, for instance, famously says, we must seek ye first the political kingdom, right? And then all else will follow. And then sometimes there's an argument that's much more like an argument for their kind of necessary co-constitution, that these two things go hand in hand. Now, both, of course, in our own time, but at the time that this set of arguments was being made, this was a deeply contested set of claims. Yeah, I think so. Just the second part was just sometimes it appears that they're co-constituted and sometimes this like chronological ordering. And I was just saying that each of these were critiqued in their own time by kind of architects of the human rights instrument. And of course, this is also a central point of debate in the contemporary literature on human rights.
Right, right. Yeah. I was curious then, I mean, you know, just following up on this, were these thinkers happy about the outcome of construction of the UN? I mean, presumably, you know, is he happy about getting the principle of self-determination enshrined there? But presumably, based on the principles you're describing, they would have wanted to go further than that, right?
Further in what way? I mean,
I'm not exactly sure. I mean, in the sense, well, I mean, maybe this gets us into the next chapter, but in the, you know, the sort of economic side of things, which is, you know, in chapter four, you talk about the development of, you know, economic federal, you know, or forms of regional federalism that just sort of try to address economic forms of dependence that sort of emerge in post-colonial states. Maybe it's a good point to point to them, because several thinkers say a couple different contexts that you point out try to develop these kinds of federal systems in order to, you know, sort of bolster the economic power of formerly colonized states. Maybe you could talk about that. I mean, I also found interesting the sort of the way in which they drew on the United States as an example, right, of a formerly colonized state that's a, you know, as a federal states. So we could talk about that.
Yeah, sure. And I guess one thing I'll say about the, you know, their kind of limits of the UN. So on the one hand, right, getting the rights to self-determination, you know, through the UN, enshrined in the new legal instruments around human rights, is a really important victory, I think. I mean, I think from our perspective, the end of empire in that period looks like a foregone conclusion, right? And that surely this was a kind of moment that would pass, seems like in almost a historical inevitability. But I think from their perspective, this was a really important triumph. And part of why it was a triumph is that it was a way of kind of delegitimizing empire as a kind of as a form of political organization. That's one. Two, then it becomes the basis, and this might be what their dissatisfaction, persistent dissatisfaction with the UN, right? It becomes the basis to make other kinds of claims on the UN around equal decision-making power. So after the 1960 resolution is passed, there's immediately attempts to try and reform the Security Council, right, to make the General Assembly the engine of kind of a parliamentary power, let's say, for the world, right? So to try and use the newly gained right to self-determination to press for greater challenges to the structure of the UN. Of course, this also culminates in the new international economic order. But the federations, I think there's some, I would say one thing that's really interesting about the federations to me is, and it's in some ways, I think, my favorite chapter and my favorite project first, it's not a full exit, of course, but it's an attempt to try to resolve these international questions, not at the level of the international itself, but at the regional level, right? To withdraw in some sense, or to think about the space of South-South collaboration and South-South institutional formation as a place and space from which one could address this global problem. The other thing I think is really interesting about it is that it imagines that it imagines the political institutions as the solution to economic problems, basically, right? So it takes the problem of economic dependence, but whereas the new international economic order tries to think about a set of economic arrangements that might overcome this problem, here the fix is one that's institutional and political, and I think that's really interesting. But yeah, so this the kind of surprising thing I found during my archival research was how important the United States was to their thinking around this. And I hadn't expected to find this before my trips to Trinidad and Ghana, and you know, I think one thing that happens in their reading of the United States is they look to 1787 as this creation of a post-colonial federation, right? So they treat their own economic or their political economic predicament in the 20th century as not as something specific to Africa or the Caribbean, but a general problem of how one secures economic or political independence after empire. And of course, the turn to the U.S. is also supposed to be a persuasive one to their critics, given that the U.S. is now the global hegemon, right? So especially Nkrumah comes out very forthrightly. This is the only example of a post-colonial state that does not find itself under new forms of economic domination or in neo-colonial relations. And this is a comparison vis-a-vis Eastern Europe, but also South America. The other part, but they're reading, so they look to 1787, but the real institutional arrangements that they're thinking about are you know, product of the U.S. after the Civil War. They're thinking about a strong, you know, centralized state, federal state, one with the capacity to tax, right? Income tax is a, you know, a federal income tax is a 20th century development in the United States. So it's a vision of what America is that combines that moment of founding with the moment that, with the what the United States is in the 20th century.
Yeah, and they're concerned with, you know, I'm thinking again of the Federalist Papers, you know, the way with things that Hamilton and Madison were concerned, they're concerned about, you know, federal government coercing individuals. They're concerned about federal government being able to raise an army. Yeah. Or is it, you know, primarily the taxation power?
Yeah, there's less, you know, I think less of a concern around direct military conflict, or sometimes this comes up a bit more in the African context, definitely, that regionally or continentally organized defense system would be preferable to each small state defending itself. But the primary preoccupation about why you need federal power is around economic development. Taxation is one part of it, but it's basically about a planning state, which of course is, you know, decolonizing states in this period are trying to figure out how one plans a national economy, and so it's really economic powers that are the central preoccupation.
So you say a little bit about how successful these federations were, what their fate was.
Yeah, well, not very successful. the West Indian Federation was in existence for 4 brief years, from 1958 to 1962. It ends with a referendum. It was very fun to work on this as Brexit was happening. It ends in a referendum that happens in Jamaica, which was the largest state. Which ends up dissolving the rest of the other states as well. In the African context, Nkrumah's plan of a centralized federation is thwarted before it even begins. It ends up in the creation of the Organization of African Unity, which models itself not on the United States, but on the United Nations, right, as a treaty organization of independent, sovereign, equal states, right? Both end in failure. And I try to suggest there that try to think about the failure less in terms of, or in terms of these kinds of conflicts over what centralized power would mean for the member states. In both places, there would be a deep critique of the ways in which member states would now find themselves subordinated so in some ways, the anti-federalists win, unlike the case of the United States. Recently, since writing the book, one other thought I've had about this is, and this is spurred in part by something that Julius Nyerere says in response to Nkrumah and others. He says, in an earlier moment, he says, even if you're a weak state, once you have the kind of accoutrements of sovereignty, it's a much harder thing to let go of it. And he says this in arguing for the creation of an East African Federation before the states got independence. So recently I've been thinking more about how, even for the West Indies, which weren't independent when they federated, there had already been kind of the devolution of power to the specific island states. So universal suffrage was introduced to Jamaica in 1944. The formation of political parties had occurred, and kind of the domestic imagination of political imagination organized around those territorial units had already existed for over a decade by the time federation happens. So I think, and that's true, of course, of the African context too. In that case, all the states had become independent already. So I think there may be a much more path-dependent reason, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, than I think I articulated in the book.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's federations maybe were not strongly centralized enough, right? Is that the suggestion, that if they had been there had been more centralization, then maybe they've been more successful?
No, I think I'm trying to suggest that if we could turn the clock back, right, and in the 1940s, in all of these contexts, there are deep, longstanding debates and questions about federation, but more that, if given the choice, had, say, the political parties formed in Jamaica argued for a kind of region-wide extension of universal suffrage and argued for the region itself as the basis of political mobilization, electoral competition, etc. I guess what I'm trying to suggest is that part of the problem was that these projects were not grounded in the kind of mass mobilizations around anti-colonialism, right? That they were creations from the top, and they never had a full popular base. And part of the reason they didn't is because the kind of anti-colonial politics of the time, the political parties formed in the lead up of this period, had all been articulated around these territorial, colonially organized territorial units. And I'm wondering if there had been ways in which a different kind of base for the Federalist movement might have generated something else. I don't know if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah.
Definitely. So the last chapter 5, talks about the new international economic order, which is, you mentioned a few minutes ago, that organization that was born in the 60s and 70s, born out of the failures of these regional federations. I thought maybe you could say a little bit about the historical circumstances around it, the sort of economic conditions that prompted the organization, how it differed from its predecessors, and we could talk about the principles that guided it, the sort of world welfare system that it proposed. But yeah, go ahead.
So the new international economic order emerges after the failure of these Federalist projects. It also emerges in this context where the economic conditions aren't just characterized by dependence, which has been a problem throughout this period, but a what was called declining firms of trade, right? So many of these countries are primary goods producers for export, right? And the prices for those commodities, sisal or cocoa, et cetera, the prices of these commodities are rapidly declining in the late 60s. So, I mean, this comes out of dependency theory suggests that this condition isn't just a kind of random occurrence, but it's a structural problem for primary goods producing states. So that's the kind of economic condition from which the new international economic order emerges. At the same time, what I try to highlight is how the figures in this chapter are Nyerere and Manley, begin to develop a kind of critique of the modernization ambitions of someone like Nkrumah, right, to try and reorient the project of development around more egalitarian ends. They're both influenced and informed by traditions of Fabian socialism. So equality rather than modernization becomes much more central to their domestic imaginations as well as their international imaginations. And both of them begin to think about, as do others who are involved in the NIEO, that to think the world is a one world, right? We're all integrated, but it's a divided world. And to imagine or analogize that division, international division, as tantamount to the division of labor domestically. Sometimes this is rendered as the division between workers and capital. At other times, it's rendered more as the relationship between rural and urban. But the impetus of this kind of domestic analogy for both of them is to make possible the argument or to prompt the argument for internationalizing the welfare state. And the argument is that these same kinds of hierarchies, whether a hierarchy of capital and labor or rural and urban, were not fully over transcended, but equalized in the 20th century in the North Atlantic world through more redistributive states. And so the same kind of division exists on the international level, the argument is that it should prompt similar kinds of attempts at redistribution. Now, of course, the primary disanalogy is that there is no coercive state on the international stage. So they're trying to use the UN basically to institutionalize a set of policies. I mean, some of them are say about, primary kind of like unions for primary goods producing states. So like a bauxite association or a cocoa producing states association. And the idea is that this could serve as a kind of proxy of what unions do, like bargain prices, right? That's one version. The other is basically kind of stabilize commodity prices provide resources for these countries to transform or expand their ability to process their own primary goods. So these are very kind of nitty gritty parts of the NIEO, but more generally, I think there's the NIEO involved a whole set of other kind of interventions. One was to regulate transnational corporations. The second was to kind of manage and regulate the distribution of goods, right? Shipping, communications, etc. And I think I want to say one reason to think about the NIEO is because for a lot of kind of writers or people who think about this period, the primary impulse, it seems, of post-colonial states is to argue for states' rights, right? To make the case for nationalization, which of course was happening throughout this period. But what I wanted to emphasize here is how there's a simultaneous attempt at trying to create a governing apparatus for a global and globalizing economic order, and a governing apparatus that would kind of help to correct for what seems to be reoccurring and persistent structural inequalities.
Yeah, that's okay. That's really helpful, because one of the things I was curious about here is, you know, why the emphasis on welfare, you know, kind of cosmopolitan safety net, as it were, because in some ways this, you know, that particular approach seems to fall back into the kind of human rightsy, John Rawlsy type of, you know, approach to cosmopolitan global justice, which in my mind, just sort of following in the think, you know, the thoughts here is that just sort of moving money around is not going to solve the underlying structural problems that they're pointing to. But if it is the case that the NIEO is also interested in regulation of corporations, right? So, that can then, you know, give a little bit more bite to this kind of approach to, you know, providing a kind of structural change. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I think one other part of this, and this draws on work by Johanna Bachmann, a sociologist, but the other part of this is, you know, say the language of structural adjustment, which of course now is totally associated with the kind of conditionalities imposed on post-colonial states during the debt crisis. Structural adjustment was first articulated by proponents of the NIEO. And the argument was that, structural adjustment was something that each and every economy in the world would have to undergo to realize this vision of an egalitarian economic order. So, you know, in its most expansive, right, it wasn't just about holding prices stable for commodities, but also, for instance, forcing North Atlantic states to give up agricultural protections, right? Protectionism around their agricultural industries, so that post-colonial states might be able to sell their goods to those countries. And so to kind of overcome what were kind of structural dynamics, both inside countries and on the world stage, that constantly reproduce these forms of inequality. So I think in that sense, it's at its most ambitious. I think it is this attempt to overlay the globalizing economic order with a kind of infrastructure that would enable it to produce more egalitarian ends. So the other thing I think is worth mentioning here is that in some ways this is, as you say, with the use of welfare, it is in some sense a very liberal imaginary, right? It's also one that in some ways imagines free trade, right? Like the reduction of protectionism, even if it's focused on the global north, is still one that imagines that one way to equality will be through expansion of trade, right? Even if it's regulated trade on the international stage. And so this kind of vision would be severely critiqued by another school of kind of, dependency theorists, the world systems theorists, by people like Emmanuel Wallerstein and Samir Amin, who didn't think any form of further integration into the economic order was going to resolve these structural problems of inequality, but simply deepen them.
Yeah, I mean, I think of some libertarians these days who are willing to say, look, let's go all in for welfare. Fine with that. Safety net.
Yeah.
But less regulation, right? That's the path to the greatest welfare for the greatest number. But, you know, that's going to be the key point to be challenged here. It's not the, you know, that's not going to be true. That's not going to provide the kind of equality of, of status and independence on the part of these countries that they're looking for.
Yeah.
I was wondering, you know, sort of, you know, did these thinkers point towards a world state? Did they tinker with a world state? Because I guess I'm wondering how this ultimately is going to be possible without something like a world state.
Yes, the only person who really mentions a world state is Julius Nyerere. He mentions it, but doesn't endorse it. I mean, he says this isn't. He has similar critiques that other kind of people who are interested in regionalism or even cosmopolitanism have of the world state, that it would be dominating in some way. That's one, but he also has a sense of kind of there's cultural pluralism, there's political pluralism in the world, and that it's worth preserving that. We wouldn't want to make the world uniform in that sense, and there would be no way to do that under the configurations of a world state. But he's the only one who really thinks, even raises it as a possibility.
Yeah, so I wanted to close by talking about your epilogue. In part, this is, there's a sad conclusion to this book, which is much of the developments that you're talking about were sort of displaced by, the neoliberal movements, the neoliberal developments of the 70s and 80s. And so it sort of led to a decline in this kind of thinking about international organizations with the aims that these thinkers held. But I guess I wanted to ask you sort of what you see on the horizon, in the sense that, are you optimistic or are you pessimistic? I get the sense from the very kind of last few paragraphs that maybe there is a little bit of optimism to hold on to. I mean, do you see us in the United States and elsewhere moving towards resurgence of these ideas and sort of more of egalitarian internationalism or more of the same or more of a reaction backwards?
Yeah. It's hard to, I think it was a really bleak ending. And so I think the last parts of the last paragraphs, as you suggest, is an attempt to try and point to some set of possibilities. And I think I do see some set of possibilities around the revival of political mobilization on, questions of racial hierarchy in the U.S. and elsewhere around the world. A kind of newly resurgent language of reparations, again, both here, but also in the regions of the world I study. But I think more, I think the lesson for us from this book is, of course, we're not going to reproduce or repurpose their political projects. But one of the things I think I find really inspiring about the figures I write about is how they're able to try and think with the kind of institutions and political openings that they have, right? As I said, like 1945, it was the end of World War II, but for many of these figures, it felt like, they colonial subjects fought in World War II, and they were going to get nothing, that the kind of project of empire was going to persist. But still, there was this sense in which to try and leverage what was possible within the United Nations to transform that space and to make it really a site for the project of decolonization. So I think it's more about like how to attune ourselves, even in the moments that feel that are characterized by political, that what feel like political closure, as to those spaces of possibility, even when they feel and are often very narrow. That's, I think, one lesson for me. The second, I think, is about how the writing of history might help to shake us out of the ways in which we may be stuck in particular kinds of conceptual and political dead ends. And that's partly what readers will have to see if they think that the book accomplishes that. But I think that's something that my own figures do, right? So in the 30s, for instance, there's this resurgence of writing about the history of slavery and emancipation. And I take that to be an attempt to think their present from this historical perspective. And that historical writing would also generate this thesis of empire's enslavement. So it's to also suggest that the way we think about our political future is intimately tied, I think, to the ways we narrate our political pasts.
Well, Adam, this has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate you you discussing your book with me on the Political Theory Review. So thanks again for joining.
Thanks so much. This was great.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.